Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Juliet Escoria's debut novel is called Juliet the Maniac. It's about a 14-year-old honors student named Juliet, whose life is derailed by drug use, self-harm, and bipolar disorder. These are all issues that Juliet herself has struggled with in real life, which raises the question of why she decided to write this book as a novel rather than a memoir.
I get that question kind of a lot, and it's strange because I didn't really think of it as anything but a novel. I'm not entirely sure why. It's kind of funny because genre doesn't really matter, but you tell yourself you're writing fiction or you tell yourself you're writing nonfiction. I always enjoy thinking that I'm writing fiction more. Like, I feel like there's less rules and I'm not confined to stick to the truth, and kind of my natural inclination when writing is to just make stuff up when I feel like it. And I just prefer reading novels to memoir as well, so probably some bias that isn't necessarily logical for writing a novel. But mostly it was so that I wouldn't be stuck to the truth and I could make things up if I wanted to kind of like illustrate something.
Yeah, so you'd have more creative freedom to not have to stick to the truth and make things up. Yeah, and I kind of thought that was one of the reasons. I also wondered if another reason maybe would be because you're revisiting such painful, harrowing memories. By writing it as a novel, did it make it less painful to have to go back and deal with this?
I don't think so. I mean, this was a very difficult book to write in a lot of ways. I mean, I do think there is some sort of safety, a bit of feeling of safety by calling it fiction. And I feel like if people don't admit that, they might be lying a little bit to themselves. I think also that I feel like memoir kind of has some sort of lesson to it, and I was not interested in kind of like explaining what this means to me now as much. There's the letters from the future, but in general, I didn't really want to explain kind of how this all feels now. It was just kind of like the feeling of being so disoriented by what you're going through at the time. So kind of doing it as a novel seemed like readers might be willing to not have the explanation and the lesson.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you're not a fan of the big takeaway. One big message that we're supposed to take away from it.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
So I'll scratch that off my list. How did the bipolar disorder manifest itself?
Similar to this, of course you can't cover everything, but the things that were really alarming were the auditory hallucinations and the visual hallucinations. It's pretty much impossible to not feel crazy if you're seeing and hearing things that aren't there. And then the lack of sleep, that was awful.
Yeah,
I've had sleep problems even going back to it when I was a little kid.
You mentioned the auditory and visual hallucinations. Can you describe and give us a kind of an example of what those
mean, it was a lot of, it wasn't very interesting. It was a lot of like ringing phones and buzzing sounds and kind of like whispers. And then the visual was pretty shadowy types of things. And then there's a scene in the book where she sees skulls coming out of the wall. And that was based on what had happened to me in class, which was very alarming if you're sitting in class and all of a sudden you start seeing skulls coming out of the wall. So,
yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Juliet the Maniac. And if you could set it up, that would be great.
Okay. So Juliet has been dealing with small everyday teenage issues, and then her bipolar symptoms are starting to manifest themselves and she's having difficulty managing. So she wrote a letter for her parents and they took her to a therapist to try and get the issues addressed. And she was put on medication. They didn't know this in the 90s, but apparently putting juvenile patients, particularly bipolar juvenile patients, on antidepressants puts them at a risk for suicidal actions and thoughts. So she'd been placed on antidepressants about 3 weeks before this attempt. The other thing took over, pushing me into the bathroom. I watched my hand take out my medicine, Tegretol, Wellbutrin. The pills poured onto the counter in a neat pile. It didn't seem like enough. I walked into the kitchen, the tiny cupboard where my mom kept the vitamins and headache medicine. There is a big bottle of Tylenol from Costco. There's a smaller bottle of Benadryl, too. I set both of them down on the counter. I grabbed one of the kitchen chairs. I dragged it in front of the fridge. There is a bunch of liquor bottles on top. I grabbed the gin. I stepped down, got a tall glass. I poured the gin into it until it was full. I didn't put the bottle back. I took the glass and the pill bottles and went into the bathroom. I poured the Tylenol and Benadryl out next to the other pills, threw all of the bottles in the trash. They look pretty, the white of the Tylenol and Tegretol mixed with the bright pink and red of the other pills. I grabbed a handful, shoved them in my mouth, swallowed them with the gin until it was all gone. They went down my throat so easy it was like they belonged there. I went into my bedroom. The lights were off and the room was very dark. I laid down on the bed. My eyelids grew heavy and I closed them. Everything felt thick and dumb. I think I fell asleep. I dreamt I was tied, my hands behind my back, my feet together. Someone had lit me on fire. The flame that burned me was very white and very hot, but it didn't hurt. I couldn't see anything else but flames. I lost place in my body. I became the fire. And then my dad was shaking me. I opened my eyes and the fire was gone. He was sitting on the bed over me. It looked like there were three of him. My mother was over his shoulder. There were three of her too. Her face glistened. I think she was crying and the tears glowed, brilliant as stars. The next thing I knew, I was in the car. My mother was in the back seat with me. My face was against the window, the glass cool on my cheek. She kept on saying my name over and over, her hand grabbing my arm. It seemed too difficult to answer her, and so I didn't. We were on the freeway, and the other car lights went by in streaks and blurs, like lines of fire.
One of the things that's really striking about your writing is the pacing. You managed to include these very vivid details, yet you still maintain this unrelenting narrative propulsion. How do you decide how much detail to include in your sentences?
I mean, that's kind of a tough question. It's like I am thinking very much about the effect that it will have on the reader. And I do care a lot about the way things sound and kind of like the musicality almost of the sentences. Like I can tell, at least what I kind of require when I consider a draft done is that to feel as though the words are kind of bouncing off each other in a weird way, like almost like a musical beat.
Mm-hmm.
If it seems like a more unusual feeling that I'm trying to describe that maybe most people haven't felt, maybe spend a little bit more time there to kind of slow it down so people can really understand what the feeling might be like. But I do really like doing description.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of weighing how important it is that I'm describing versus page space.
Right. I read in an interview where you talked about you don't see the point of describing things like hand gestures.
Or, yeah.
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 You want your writing to be as short as possible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, not so short that there's no description. And yeah.
And
yeah.
I do also enjoy kind of whittling away. Like that's one part of writing that I think is really fun, is just trimming as much as I can possibly trim.
I'm sure that's easier than coming up with new stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're writing about life experiences that happened half a lifetime ago, 20, 23 years ago. How are you able to tap into these old memories so effectively?
Well, I think a lot of it is we all have stories that we tell other people about ourselves and we tell ourselves about ourselves. And so a lot of times those memories will stay fresher. And it's almost like, are you remembering that event or are you remembering the retelling of that event so many times? I also kind of feel like I still have a teenage girl side to me, which is sometimes not good. And so just kind of tapping into that side of my personality that's kind of judgmental and insecure, or, you know, the stereotypes we have about teens.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also just very hard to forget how strange the whole situation was of just being completely overcome by something you don't understand at all and like seems like it's coming from nowhere, but it's from inside your own head.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you said you don't have a good memory for facts, but you have a good sensory memory.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't remember much about my biology classroom with the skull hallucinations, but I do remember, like, well, at least I think I remember exactly how that felt. Just kind of, like, the terrifying feeling of that and just feeling like a freak.
Yeah. That's a really good tool to have, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not very useful when I try to remember the movie I saw the other night.
Yeah. You obviously gave a lot of thought to the structure of Juliet the Maniac. You've included patient logs, letters, newspaper clippings, letters from the future written by the adult Juliet. Why did you want to include all these other elements in your book?
Well, the ones that you mentioned, the found objects or documents or whatever you'd like to call them, and then the letters from the future, both of those were pretty instinctual. Like, I didn't think about them too much. I just had like wanted to put them in, but then in the editing process, it was like, what is this doing? And so kind of asking myself, what purpose does this serve? And then I was able to come up with enough reasons for both that I let them stay and kind of played around with those the way you might edit anything else, expanding here and cutting there and that type of thing. But I felt like the one thing I just think is odd is that there's not more pictures in books in general. Like, it doesn't seem like it would be out of the question in terms of technology. And we are such a kind of a visual way we process the world with social media and the internet and that type of thing. So why not put pictures
in
absolutely.
Books? Yeah, absolutely. It was great the way you used those, too.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. In her review of your book for The Atlantic, Rosa Inocencia Smith writes that by including these additional elements, readers are immersed in the girl's state of mind, but can also see what her experience looks like from the outside. Is that something else you were going for?
Yeah. I mean, like she's definitely an unreliable narrator, which is A, she's a teenager, and B, she's mentally ill and uses drugs. And so just kind of some sort of alternate perspective. But the adults in her life aren't always reliable either. But I do think it kind of gives you an alternate perspective of what she's going through.
Yeah, it was a real smart move on your part.
Well,
it's very
you.
Effective. Well, one of the most poignant scenes, in my mind anyway, in your book, occurs when Juliet is staying at the therapeutic boarding school, Redwood Trail School.
Mm-hmm.
She has this conversation with one of the employees named Rosie. I'd like you to read an excerpt from that part, and please set it up, if you don't mind.
So after the second suicide attempt, she gets sent to this, what is called a therapeutic boarding school. And so it's a little bit discipline-based, but mostly the focus for the kids is things like doing farm work and nature activities. And then also they have group therapy and regular therapy. So she's been here for a few months. And this is a bit of a turning point for her.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Rosie was married to a truck driver named Denny, but I hadn't really considered what that meant. Turns out it meant she was alone a lot of the time. Her kids were alone a lot, too. The oldest, her son, had to be the parent sometimes. He put the others to bed when she worked the night shift, prepared breakfast in the morning, made sure everyone got to school on time. She said she felt loneliness in herself, but it was worse when she saw it in him because she knew it was her fault. But I have to look at the positives, she said. Denny's gone a lot of the time, sure, but we have good health insurance, a nice home. Plus, with him being away so much, we don't have time to argue or get bored with each other the way most people do. I swear his job is what's kept us going for these 15 years. She put her fingers on her hairsprayed curls, twisting them in a way that was almost girlish. You know, there's good in everything, she said. It's just sometimes you have to dig a little harder to get it out. She was quiet for a bit, and I was too. Now you, she said. She reached across the table to hold my hand. Hers were warm and plump. Mom hands. You're sensitive, and that means extra pain, extra loneliness, extra sadness. But it also means extra joy. She said, your job is to dig for the gold. God's given you a shovel. You just have to figure out how to use it.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a powerful moment because Rosie is showing tremendous faith in Juliet's ability, despite her current situation, Juliet's ability to find some happiness in the future. And I'm wondering, have you yourself been able to find the extra joy in addition to the extra pain, extra loneliness, and extra sadness that you've experienced in your life?
I mean, it took a really long time and like lots of work, but I feel really grateful to have had these particular troubles, like with the bipolar disorder and the addiction, because I feel like it has given me an appreciation for things that I might not have otherwise. So I do like kind of like the effect that it's had, but it took a very long time to kind of get there. Just being able to enjoy really simple things like maybe the way that the sky looks on a particular day or spending time with my friends or whatever it is in a way I don't think I would have been kind of forced to stop and think about things and really try hard to find things out of life that I love and that make me happy.
Mm-hmm. Was there something that happened, some sort of turning point that you can point to? That
getting sober helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I did the thing where you sit in church basements with other people. You know, you really have to work hard if you want to be okay with that. But I think mostly it was kind of a slow progression and getting better at doing things like therapy and asking people in my life for help. And it's odd that I think that therapy is a skill and you don't know that skill when you first start in, which is often when people need the therapy to be effective the most, when they're kind of at that crisis mode. but over time, learning how to kind of make that work well for me. But it's been kind of a long, slow journey.
I'm a huge fan of Sparks, so I was delighted to discover that you included their song Angst in My Pants for a soundtrack that you curated for your book. What is it about Angst in My Pants that you like?
It just feels kind of jittery and uncomfortable, but also like there's a happiness there too. The mania I felt at this point in my life was very different than the type I felt as an adult, and it was what a doctor would describe as mixed state. So it's like you have a lot of depressive symptoms in addition to the, you know, generally associated with positive symptoms of mania. And so I like that song because it sounds like sort of happy and energetic, but also discomfort.
It's that combination, exactly. Julia Escoria, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Juliet Escoria is the author of Juliet the Maniac. Find out more about Julia at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Chuck Klosterman, Javier Grigio-Marx-Watch, and Juliet Escoria. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You poor dumb son of a bitch. You've done more damage than you know.
Our executive, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I picked you for the job not because I think you're so darn smart, but because I thought you were a shade less dumb than the rest of the outfit.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You don't know who you're dealing with! Don't ever tell me what I can't do, ever! This is destiny.